The two questions are, Western man were to become a fully enlightened being, what would happen to his human relationships, particularly love? And the second is, what do I think of the I Ching? Let me start with the word love for a moment. I think there is a transformation that goes on in what one's conception of the term love means. And I think one changes from seeing it as a verb to seeing it as a state of being. And you move much more towards what would be called Christ love, that is, the state of being where one is love. One is like a light that emits, and one is a loving being. And that a consciousness and energy are an identity, as I said last night. And similarly with those identities is the term love. That is, that love, consciousness are one and the same thing. So that as you get into a higher state of consciousness, you come closer to being in love. That doesn't mean in interpersonal love, it means being love. Now, if you and I make love or fall into love, and I say, she really turns me on, I love her, from this model, what I see is happening is I am saying, you are a, in the imprinting literature, you are a superordinate key stimulus that is eliciting a innate response mechanism. You're releasing an innate response mechanism in me. Where I could say it in a more general sense, saying that you're turning me on. And you're turning me on to a place inside myself that is love. So I am experiencing what it means to, quote, be in love. And I'm saying, I am in love with you. I am in love with my connection to the place in me that is love, is the way I would now say it in this Western framework. See? Now, to keep working with this, I would say that as many of you, I suspect, have had that experience of making love to somebody, now making love, and getting totally into interpenetration as much as your bodies would allow and your thoughts and feelings would often allow, and still feel that there was a separateness. And it is interesting that as long as you are under the illusion that what you are loving is out there, you will always experience that separateness. And that it is only when you begin to understand that if you and I are truly in love, if I go to the place in me that is love, and you in the place to you that is love, we are together in love. We start to understand that what love means is that we are sharing a common state together, and that that state exists in you and it exists in me. Now, the enlightened being, what happens to him is that he changes the nature of his love object from a specific love object to it all, finally. You would say that an enlightened being is totally in love with the universe, in the sense that everything in the universe turns him on to that place in himself where he is love and consciousness. So I would say that an interpersonal relationship that has got any qualities of possessiveness in it or ego drama of any kind certainly undergoes changes as the nature of consciousness changes. And at the same moment, I would say that as a person becomes more conscious, he understands that he has certain karmic commitments, that is, existing contracts, which may be with parents, it may be with husband or wife, it may be with children, and that he cannot rip himself from these without creating a karmic cost, that is, without leaving behind him some uncooked seeds that he's running away from. And that the game of enlightenment starts from exactly where you are at this moment. And therefore, if you have an existing social, emotional, sexual contract with another human being, that's where it starts. And to say, well, I got to go do my work on myself, I can't afford you anymore, leaves a ripping which ultimately you've got to rectify. There's no doubt about it. You've got to work from where you are now. You just can't walk away from anything, any part of your life. You've got to bring it all into harmony at every new level. So that I am in India and I suddenly realize that I have to come back. My mother's died. I have to come back and be with my father in a new way than I was ever with him before. When I came back to Boston from India, I arrived at the airport and I was wearing a beard, and I was barefoot. I had come from India with my tambora, and I was generally a weird-looking being. And my father came in his car to pick me up, and a conservative, as I said, a conservative Boston Republican, and a very responsible member of our society. And he took one look at me, and his response was, "Get in quick before anybody sees you." Which I did, and we started to drive towards the house. Now, what he regaled me with all the way home was the fact that he was experiencing a depression, a deep depression, as he approached death. He was 72 at the time. And he told me all about how his life was meaningless, and even though he had started Brandeis University and raised many funds for Einstein Medical School and been president of the New Haven Railroad and done lots of glorious and grand things in his life, he was experiencing the feeling that he was a failure as a human being. That was all there was to it. And he was telling me about his will and the clauses in his will, and all I felt was I was sitting in the car doing my om mani padme hum. And it was like his mind was creating this huge, big, black cloud of pollution in the car. I mean, this heavy, dark, depressed place of it's all over, and we'll look through the old photographs tonight, and, you know, that kind of place. And I just did my mantra, and off we drove to the house. And we got home, and he said, "What would you like to do now?" And I said, "I don't care, Dad, anything you'd like to do." And he said, "Well, I want you to rest. You've had a long trip." And he says, "I'm going to make some raspberry jam," because that's one of his hobbies, is making raspberry jam. So I said, "Well, can I help you?" "No, don't bother." I said, "I'd like to." He said, "All right, come in." So I go in, and we start to make raspberry jam, and we're sterilizing bottles and mashing raspberries, and he's telling me about the horror of his life and how sad it is and how everybody's forgotten him. And boy, he's got a root. It's a very heavy story, very heavy story. And I feel fantastic compassion for him because I love him very dearly. And at the same moment, I see the predicament his consciousness is in. I see where he's stuck. So I'm just doing my mantra and mashing raspberries and so on. And I'm saying to him things like, "Should the bubbles all rise to the top? The bottle's right? Where do we put that?" and so on. And after a while, since I'm giving him no reinforcement at all for this fantastic dark cloud that he's creating and holding all by himself, since I'm part of us, but I'm not helping him hold it up particularly, he starts to say, "Well, get all the bubbles up," and pretty soon his conversation is shifting until it's in the here and now. That is, he's talking about how to make raspberry jam, right? And as he starts to talk about how to make raspberry jam, this is a technique you're all familiar with, of bringing a person into the here and now, the lines of his face are relaxing, and the whole model of himself as somebody who's old and about to die, and his life is lived out, and all the stuff about his failures and unhappiness and bankruptcy of the railroad and all that stuff, that's all sort of falling into the past, and here we are making raspberry jam. We're just two guys making raspberry jam, right? Now, we finish making the raspberry jam, and he's happy. See, he's smiling. So now his question is, what are we going to do together next, right? Because what's happening is he's getting a contact high off me because I'm living in the here and now. All I'm doing is making raspberry jam. And so he's coming into that place and it feels good because everybody wants to feel good. And he's coming into that place and he feels good. So if I walk away for an hour or two, he'll go right back into that other space again because that's his karma at that moment to be stuck still in that space. But we start to spend a great deal of time together, and as we spend more and more time together, he's living more in the here and now. To shortcut the whole story, let me explain that 8 months later, I gave the bride away at his marriage, right? And as we went into he married a woman in her late 50s, a beautiful, high, wonderful woman who had actually been one of his secretaries in the Junior Achievement Organization, of which he was president. And it was another junior achievement for him. And, as he went into the temple, he said to me, "This is all you're doing, you know." Okay? And because what I did was hold his hand all the time, because all of his questions would be about the future or the past. Like, is this wrong in terms of the memory of mother? Is this going to be a terrible thing later? And all I was saying was, "How does it feel today? Did you have a good time at dinner last night? What are we doing today?" And he said, "Oh, it's wonderful. She's a wonderful person, but I'm just concerned about..." And as soon as his mind stopped creating all that stuff about then and then, and he lived here, it was a gas, and he was having a ball, and he was writing love songs, and They went on a honeymoon to Scotland and Ireland, and when I call them now, she is a very high being in that she lives in the here and now very much of the time. She's a very conscious being. He married a good one. Right? And he's in good hands. And when I call, I say, what are you doing? Oh, well, we're, and he sort of laughs, we're writing some songs at the piano. We're writing some movie routines. We're going to shoot some sound movies and have some people over. And he's having a ball. He is no more 74 now. You know, he was, before he was 96, and now he's about 23, the way I figure it. And he can't walk as well, and he's slowing down and all his processes, but they're all just, there they are. And the depression has fallen away because he started to live in the here and now.